Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelzang. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Partnership Program, our guest today, Scott Turow, will be presenting his wide-ranging subjects and expertise, including his new book, Testimony, May 18th in Washington, D.C. at the Ridley Center. For ticket information, please check our website or at smithsonianassociates.org. Of course, Scott Turow needs little introduction. As an attorney and writer, Scott is author of 9 best-selling works of fiction, including his first novel, Presumed Innocent. His works of nonfiction include 1L, about his experience as a law student, which is still required reading for first-year law students 40 years after its publication. His books have been translated into more than 25 languages, sold more than 30 million copies worldwide, and have been adapted into full-length films and 2 television miniseries. Scott continues to work part-time as an attorney, devoting substantial amounts of his time and efforts to pro bono matters. As you'll hear in our interview, Scott is active in a number of charitable causes that promote literacy, education, and legal rights. I first met Scott in his role as president of the Authors Guild, the nation's largest membership organization of professional writers. Scott continues to work on behalf of authors, artists, and copyright protection. Please join me in welcoming Scott Turow to the show today. Well, Scott Turow, author, longtime lawyer, really it is wonderful to talk to you. I have to tell you that we're recording this show on April 24th. During last week's Jeopardy game show installments, one of the questions was, this Windy City lawyer sets books like The Burden of Proof in Kendall County, a stand-in for Chicago. I thought that was a great question on Jeopardy, given kind of our timely conversation today. Your new book, Testimony, takes place worlds away from Kendall County, but I thought we'd start at the start and maybe hear a little bit from you about Testimony, and I think Kendall County is going to still be in there a little bit, but tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, Testimony is about an American lawyer, Bill Tenboom, who is from Kendall County, in fact, has been the chief federal prosecutor there in his past life. And at the age of 54, gets the opportunity to go to The Hague as a prosecutor in a war crimes investigation. And he is in a state of midlife confusion, and he accepts this case, understanding that it's politically sensitive. And it's politically sensitive because the allegation, which has gone uninvestigated for more than a decade, is that in the waning days of the NATO peacekeeping in Bosnia, American troops may have been involved in the massacre of 400 gypsies in a refugee camp on the outskirts of this circle of American bases. So there is a witness, Ferko Rinchik, who describes how a group of masked paramilitaries came into this refugee camp and took everybody away in trucks and then buried them alive in a strip coal mine. So that's the beginning of Testimony, and the book crosses Europe, and as Tenboom tries to get to the bottom of what Ferko is talking about, he goes back and forth to the United States. He returns often to Kendall County. So that's the sort of background of Testimony.
It sounds like a fascinating book. I'm really looking forward to reading it, and I know that my audience is going to be interested in this book too, because your books really do center an awful lot on these wonderful characters. The cases are always a big part of the book too, but how do you balance the two? How do you balance kind of the characterization, developing that, making sure to give that that character heart. I've read a phrase that you use, getting your head right with the character. How do you do that balanced against some of this real world stuff that's going on in Bosnia? And
well, I believe that character and plot are one, and that the turns in the plot reveal either details of the character of the protagonist or of other people in the story. And so it's not this push and pull between character and story that people sometimes envision. And I say all of that acknowledging that the plots in my novels are always complicated. Mm-hmm. Testimony is no exception. It starts in the courtroom and involves a long, complicated investigation in The Hague and Bosnia and in the United States. And the figures involved are a prominent advocate for the Roma, an attractive English female barrister, a general, a State Department friend of Bill Tenboom's, investigator who's a former Belgian policeman, who's actually a forensic anthropologist by training. I have this large stew of characters, but I have a very clear idea by the time I finish, anyway, of where I'm going with all of them, and what the overall purposes of the book are. So it just to back away from testimony a little bit. There is a reason in terms of Bill Tenboom's life experience, even though he doesn't recognize it, why he feels drawn to the International Criminal Court and this role of being a war crimes prosecutor. Something's going on inside him. Mm-hmm. And so the plot, the machinations of the plot of finding out a lot about the Roma, the gypsies, and why they would have been massacred is also an investigation for Tenboom of, deep personal issues that relate to his parents. And that's typical of what I try to get going on in these novels.
We are with Scott Turow, author. Scott is going to be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates program talking about his new book, Testimony. We're talking to Scott today. Scott, D.C. is definitely a reader's town, and legal thriller readers are certainly in abundance. I think the event that you're going to be presenting at is going to be a big draw, very well attended. How does it feel coming to D.C. now? How's that changed over the years for you?
Well, it's changed a great deal at a personal level because I have a daughter who moved to D.C. And has now had three sons. So in many ways, D.C. has become one of the epicenters of my emotional universe, which is not something that I necessarily would have expected. When I graduated from college in 1970, I actually moved to D.C. briefly. I worked at the General Services Administration. And so I've always, I've always known the city. I've always had some sense for it. I don't really think in that nearly 50-year period, I don't know if there's another American city that has changed quite as much as Washington, D.C., which is a weird thing to say because, of course, the central enterprise has remained exactly the same. The big business in town, as we all know, is government. And yet, as a residential city, as a sophisticated city, it's a great place to eat. In terms of urban renewal, and bad traffic. I mean, D.C. is, has become a national leader. So it certainly wasn't in 1970. It was a place where everyone complained about the fact that there was nowhere good to go except for Sanssouci, it was a good town for drinking and on various watering holes around Capitol Hill and that much else. And so the rise of the Kennedy Center began part of a really interesting transformation in Washington that I've enjoyed as a now very, very frequent visitor.
Well, congratulations on your being a grandfather, and certainly many in my audience are right there too. Life seems good. I'm glad for you for that. And let's go back for just a second and maybe kind of talk about some of your early days in writing and the book 1L. You mentioned this authenticity that you really exact when you write. After law school, that legal career really beckoned, and it's been a really nice, obvious blend between writing and your legal career to this day. But certainly, one kind of begets the other, and it's kind of an interesting marriage to have this career as a practicing attorney, because you're still practicing a bit to this day, right? Still,
I am. Yeah, absolutely.
But yet, being a very successful author, so that really gives you the chance to use some of this legal knowledge and this presence of the industry to bring about some of this authenticity that you're known for, that has really created this wonderful genre that you are the leader in, and that's this legal thriller area.
Right. Well, it's a complete accident, of course. I would love to. I'd love to take credit for all of this, but like a lot of people in life who sometimes want to give themselves great credit for, having literally traveled blindfolded through life. I won't do that. My great ambition as an adolescent and young adult was to be a novelist. And I went to the Creative Writing Center at Stanford. I did a master's degree there. I taught in the English department. And then I realized that academic life was not for me. And in asking myself what I was really interested in, I got a very unexpected answer, which was law. I was much more interested in what my friends who'd become lawyers were doing than anything that I would be doing as an English professor. And that is not to diss English professors. Some of my best friends, literally.
Mine too, yeah.
are English professors. But I was lucky enough to recognize at a young age that I was headed in the wrong direction. And so I went to law school. I didn't know what to expect, except that I knew what legal problems were, and I was fascinated with the way of analyzing and dealing with those issues. And I'd actually written a novel about a rent strike and become fascinated with something called the implied warranty of habitability. I was just lucky because I had very accidentally figured out a subject that I was passionate about. And that kind of personal passion ends up being good for a writer. I was reading something over the weekend by a friend of mine who's a very, very talented, bright guy. He's a good writer. But the one thing I have to tell him is, well, now you have to find something you actually care about. And that is always central, to good writing. In my case, I was lucky enough to find the law. And I'm still fascinated by legal problems. Somebody starts talking about a case, I always want to sit down and hear about it. And as I said, that was, I can't claim great personal insight. I didn't map out my life. I was lucky enough to find the law and fuse that with my lifelong ambition to write fiction. And there were a number of discoveries along the way, but I like to tell people, and when I meet them, and you know, very often people say, "Oh God, I don't understand how you could write a novel. It's all those pages. How do you do it?" And I say with great sincerity, everybody is good at something, and I was lucky enough to figure out what I was good at and what I cared about.
It's interesting, too, over the course of your legal career, as I kind of tracked some of this preparation for our conversation today, I noticed this real devotion to a couple of areas within our kind of criminal justice system. I think, you know, you look at the timing of your, you know, kind of career trajectory with the O.J. Simpson trial, court TV, you know, Black Lives Matter, events in Ferguson and Baltimore, yes, close by here. Maybe talk a little bit about some of what you've seen in the way of, you know, changed behavior in criminal procedure within the criminal justice system, good or bad even, and how African-American maybe and white Americans have kind of a different experience within the criminal justice system. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that entire area.
Well, you've asked a lot of good questions at once. So let me just first talk a tiny bit about my literary career and then go on to the aspects of my legal career that are involved. You mentioned O.J. Simpson in the 1980s, and you're right. I was lucky enough to write Presumed Innocent, came out in 1987, when there was a sort of, I can't say renaissance, because it, to some extent it was new, but a booming American interest in the law. And the Simpson case very much captured what was a large American fixation with the courtroom and things that happened. The Simpson case itself was almost like Othello in its implications about race and fame in American society. And of course that theme played throughout the case, both in the sense that, you know, OJ came from a very poor background and, you know, rose on football into this sort of elevated upper class existence. And yet, what saved him was the fact that, you know, the minority community in L.A. Was not willing to cut him loose, and they regarded him at the end of the day as another black man being mistreated by the police, which, in my view, was a perception that was warranted. I made my career as a writer of op-eds by writing a op-ed for the New York Times that I wrote before the verdict, but explaining why O.J. Had been acquitted. So I wrote it before I knew what the verdict was, but I knew what the verdict would be, mm-hmm, because it was clear to me what was happening in that case, which was that the prosecutors were dissing the minority community in L.A. the way the prosecutors and police had for generations. Mm-hmm. My own background, going back to the mid-1960s, was with involvement in the civil rights movement. I had been a member of the youth board of the NAACP and the head of the youth section of the Urban League when I was in high school. We don't think of the NAACP anymore as a radical organization, but in 1965 in the northern suburbs of Chicago, you know, I might as well have been regarded as Lenin. And, you know, the history of white-black relations took a dramatic turn when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968. And, you know, to a lot of people, it was taken as proof that there couldn't be a white-black alliance, that, you know, there was such ingrained racism in the white community in the United States that it would be up to black people on their own to liberate themselves. And people like me were essentially evicted from the civil rights movement. You know, we've gone through many, many phases. And my attitude was that it took 40 years for the wound of Dr. King's assassination to begin to heal with the election of President Obama. The problem with President Obama's election, and I've known the president for many, many years, like as do many Chicagoans in the legal community, and the one message I sent him through a mutual friend after November of 2008 is what I said is, you're going to have a very hard time doing anything as significant as your election. And many people, black and white, expected the Obama presidency to be transformational. It was. Mm-hmm. It was. And it will be looked back historically as transformational because it really did complete one of those arcs that Dr. King talked about that always bend toward justice. But in the African-American community, the belief that having an African-American president would somehow solve all problems, which, you know, is a fantasy. It wasn't just confined to the African-American community. But, of course, the problems are deeper and more complicated and more stubborn than any of us were willing to allow in 2008. And so I think that the Obama election, in point of fact, increased the frustration level in many poor communities. And so it is not a new thing. And I say this as somebody who's been a criminal defense lawyer and done a lot of pro bono work. It is not a new thing that the police manhandle minority defendants. And, you know, here in Chicago, we had a long-running investigation of defendants who were literally tortured in one of the Chicago station houses. And it's not a new thing that young black men have been shot by the police. And I say this as somebody who's both represented those young black men and represented police officers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the description of police work as relentless boredom relieved only by moments of absolute terror is one that has always had great piquancy to me. It's certainly what I've observed. And, you know, we can't even begin to talk about these problems without talking about, you know, what the gun manufacturers have done to the United States by putting all of these weapons in all of these, in all of the hands, including in the poor community. And, you know, you talk about the West and the South side of Chicago, where, you know, any police officer working there would be out of his or her mind not to be terrified every time they get out of their vehicle, because everybody is so heavily armed. And, you know, that's another part of the problem. The fact that, you know, the police feel that their lives are threatened every day. And that's a reality. So we have a large mix of factors. The, you know, and the ingrained poverty in places like Ferguson that doesn't seem to get better enough. And, you know, my own observation over the course of more than 50 years now is, of course, that there are two stories in the African-American community in the United States. There are places like the West and South side of Chicago, which on many blocks don't look any different than when Dr. King arrived there in 1965. People are just as poor and maybe even further behind. And then there's the important other side of the story, the emergence of an African-American middle class, people who, like, you know, the neighbors I see out my window, who have, you know, good jobs and found educational opportunities and have emerged into the American middle class and upper middle class and even upper class. In a few instances. So it really is a tale of two cities. That doesn't help if you're the poor person in Ferguson, because you just feel you've been left further behind. So, and we have a lot of work to do as a country. And in typical American fashion, you know, there seems to be a national temper, at least in many quarters, to simply turn away from what needs to be done. But you know, so we'll go through a few years of retrenching, and then we'll summon our will and move forward again. That's how progress always goes.
It is a complicated issue, and I know that your depth on these subjects is really going to make for a wonderful event on the 18th of May at the Smithsonian Associates. We'll put links up to the various pages where you can find out more information about Scott Turow's presentation there on May 18th. I know you're going to be talking about these important subjects as well as your important new book, Testimony. We're thrilled to have you, and we're looking forward to seeing you there. Scott Turow, thanks for joining us today with the Smithsonian Associates, and we will see you on May 18th at the Ripley Center in Washington, D.C. Scott, thanks, and good luck with this book.
Thank you, Paul.
We'll be talking to you soon. Thank you, Scott. Bye.